For the week of September 27th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 296, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. And a minute ago, you were in New York, weren't you, Sperling?
That's right. I was in New York over the weekend to see a number of shows, many of which you actually suggested. And I have to say, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, a show I now know how to pronounce. It's a play, I now know the full title of, since I've seen it. Fantastic play, wonderful play. And then this little tiny production called Hamilton. Boy, oh boy, that is unbelievable. No wonder it's getting all the hype.
The show I didn't recommend was the show that was your least favorite.
Yeah, but I kind of knew that going in. It was the kind of the, you know, Christian Borle and what's his name? David Darcy.
Brian Darcy James in Something Rotten, a musical comedy, which was eh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lovely little musical.
Well, it was great seeing you in New York, and you picked a great weekend to do it, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Unfortunately, because of the, you know, Trevor Noah tonight, he will be debuting on The Daily Show in place of Jon Stewart. Jon Stewart leaving earlier this year. Trevor Noah is taking over tonight. And there were preparations all week and weekend long. I mean, they were blocking off Fifth Avenue. They closed Central Park at one point. So there must have been a rehearsal of some kind.
I think that was the Pope.
The Pope of... Not the Pope of the United States.
Anyway.
You mean the Pope of the Catholic Church.
Yes. Yeah, so The Daily Show will debut after our podcast, but before we post. So we won't be able to talk about it till next week. But I can tell you right now, people will say it was a rocky first show. He showed some promise. We'll have to see where he ends up 6 months from now.
Right. Exactly. He's no Jon Stewart, they're going to say.
So that's what they'll say about The Daily Show. What will people say about this podcast? Because what will we be talking about?
Well, you know what else they're going to be saying about that show? Why is it on MTV? Why is it on VH1? Because it's, you know, Viacom is going all out with this. They're putting it on every network they own.
All right. Okay. Yeah. That's not that unusual, right?
Well, I guess they did for the Video Music Awards, the MTV Video Music Awards. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, they're simulcasting it on multiple channels for the first episode.
They should do that with this show, actually. Simulcast it everywhere.
And if they did, what would we be talking about?
I love the way you try and move us forward all the time. Because on this week's show, we're going to be talking about two different industries, publishing and television. Digital technology, Michael, as you know, has changed the way most consumers access both books and television program. And now there's finally data that is beginning to emerge, which documents specific reader and audience shifts in the way, you know, both of those groups are accessing new content. For instance, we'll answer, or at least try to answer, the question of why ebooks cost more than paperbacks. And explain why a television series pilot episode may not be the one, the episode that is, that gets viewers hooked. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about box office around the world, and this week is a perfect example of why we do that. The number one movie around the world is Lost in Hong Kong, the third in a trilogy. The Lost In trilogy. First was Lost in Thailand. It's directed, co-written, co-produced, and stars Chu Zhang. Hope I'm saying his name right. It opened in six territories, especially China, of course, $100 million on its opening weekend. It set records for a Chinese language film. It set records for a 2D film, which is a distinction I don't really want to make anymore. That's silly. If you can get people to pay more for your movie, then they pay more. But anyway, it opened in China and a couple other territories, $100 million on its opening weekend, a monster success story. I don't know what the budget of the film was, but it's probably not wildly expensive.
Well, you know, if there was music in it, you could say that this director, Zhu Zhang, I believe is his name.
I think Chu or Zhu, I don't know.
He's like the Lin-Manuel Miranda of China.
Oh my God. Anyway.
Well, also, by the way, you know, you said you don't like to, that. Well, because, you know, he's done everything, co-written, co-produced, he's co-starring. Yes. Just like, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda from Hamilton. Now,
this is a movie that, you know, nobody's mentioning in North America, of course, even though it opened in North America.
It did, and
it did pretty well. It opened on 28 screens, and it made $20,000 per screen. Clearly, people who speak Mandarin came out for this movie, wanted to check it out, and wanted to see it because all their friends back home were talking about it. So a nice start on a few screens for Lost in Hong Kong here in the U.S. It was number 17 for the week in North America, and it's number one around the world. And that's why when you want to track what the big movies are, it makes sense to look at the entire world, not just one territory.
Now, you mentioned you don't like kind of differentiating 2D from 3D and the biggest thing. But you know, right now, Mission Impossible Ghost Recon 5, 9, whatever it's called, Rogue Nation, it's it breaks the Hollywood 2D box office record in China for, I guess it's at $124 million right now. I'm assuming the 2D record will be shattered when this particular movie Lost in Hong Kong surpasses it.
So you're saying no movie in Hong China has made more than $125,000?
$125 million 2D.
In 3D, really?
No, in 2D. 2D.
Oh, Mission Impossible is 2D. Yeah, yes. Well, that won't last. Yes, clearly. So that record was set in China. Obviously, it's in a minute going to be the number one box office around the world. And one movie that will perhaps open up there, is it scheduled yet, is Hotel Transylvania 2. It's the comeback film for Adam Sandler. We'll get to him at the end of the box office. Let's get through it all first. Lost in Hong Kong opened with $100 million. Hotel Transylvania 2 opened around the world to $76 million. Excellent start here in North America, where it was the number one film, and a very strong start overseas, where it made $30 million. This movie was just as popular around the world as it was in the U.S., and Adam Sandler is back on top. It's an $80 million budget. It made that opening weekend. It's going to end up doing probably about the same, if not better, than the first film. You know, we'll have to see, but it's looking like it's in great shape. At number three around the world is Everest, the mountaineering film starring Jake Gyllenhaal. That made another $46 million over the weekend as it expanded in North America, and it's at $100 million worldwide. That started in platforming. It tried to build word of mouth. It went a little bit wider and didn't do great. But does that mean the platforming didn't work? I mean, people will now say, oh, it was a mistake. They should have opened it wider. Does it mean it would have done better if they'd opened it wide on first weekend? Or is it just where it would end up naturally?
I think it's probably where it would end up naturally. I don't know if these premium large format exclusives are actually working. I think time will tell. Certainly it pleases theater owners because they get to fill their big screens that first week. They're doing it with The Walk as well. I hear they might do it with The Martian. It's, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe people aren't as interested in Everest. It might just be the movie, frankly.
But I don't know that they would have gotten more money, squeezed more money out of the audience if they'd done it the other way. It certainly didn't get bad reviews. You don't want to take a bad movie and open it up limited.
No.
Because that lets the word of mouth get out. But a movie that, you know, people are enjoying decently, it certainly didn't get, you know, bad reviews. It didn't get great reviews like perhaps The Walk might do or The Martian. But, you know, I think it's just probably where it would have ended up. You know, this platforming, they've been doing it since the beginning of time, right?
Platforming? Absolutely.
Yeah. It's not some new innovation. They're acted like, oh, my God, this innovation with Mission Impossible and Everest and these movies. They're showing them, you know, on IMAX first and then a week later or 2 weeks later opening them. Well, sure, they've done that forever. So it doesn't seem like any new wrinkle. If you have confidence in your film and, of course, in this case, you think it's a spectacle that will benefit from people saying, wow, it was so cool. Well, it should work. And number four around the world is Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials, another $42 million. It's at $175 million worldwide. At number five is a film that my mom went to see a Sunday afternoon with her friends, like five of her friends, and she went to see The Intern. It's not a Schmeier film, is it? It's Nancy Myers.
A Schmeier film? It's Nancy Myers.
It's just her. It's just Nancy Myers. So it's The Intern starring Anne Hathaway and Robert De Niro, or as far as my mom is concerned, Robert De Niro and Anne Hathaway. It made $30 million on its opening weekend. Obviously, it reaches a more mature audience. They seem to enjoy it. We'll have to see where it ends up. It costs $40 million to make, so it made almost its entire budget on opening weekend.
Well, I will tell you, having seen the trailer for this film, I feel like I've seen the film.
At number six is The Visit, the M. Night Shyamalan horror flick. A big success story based on its budget. It costs $5 million to make, and it's made $66 million worldwide. It made $11 million to add to that kitty over the weekend. And number seven is Johnny Depp's Black Mass. This is his hope for an Oscar nomination and a critically acclaimed film, at least decent critical acclaim, which is much better than the blisteringly bad reviews his last few movies have received. That made $11 million over the weekend, and it's at $42 million and counting.
Are you trying to say that Mordecai did not actually get good reviews?
At number eight is Inside Out, the Pixar film. That made another $8 million, $775 million worldwide. And number nine is The Throne. I forget what country. It's South Korean, right?
I believe so.
Made another $8 million, and it's at $23 million and counting. The German comedy, Darn You, Goethe, that's at number 10. Another $7 million. It's at $52 million and counting. That's a monster success story. And here's a new movie. That's also from China, of course. It's The Third Way of Love. It's a Chinese romance about a rich guy and a poor girl who's really smart and a lawyer, and they're beautiful and they fall in love.
Wait a second. I didn't know that. What are the first two ways of love?
I don't know. This is The Third Way of Love, and the actors in the movie are now dating in real life, so it's just adorable. It made $7.5 million on its opening weekend. Don't know the budget, so I don't know how that pans out, but there you go.
But, you know, that's where the Chinese film industry and the Hollywood, you know, American film industry differ, because that whole dating your co-star thing never happens in the U.S.
And way down towards the bottom, one other new film on the charts is Accidental Detective. It's a South Korean comedy. It stars Kang Sang-woo, about a dad who helps cops. He's like just a regular old schmucky dad, but he just keeps going to the police force and going, hey, what about this? He tries to help them with cases and gets in the way, and it's very amusing. That made $3 million over the weekend, so a modest start, I assume, in South Korea for Accidental Detective.
Well, when we are looking at the worldwide box office, as Michael said, we look at all sources that we can get our hands on. And this week, I was looking at a source, and I guess it was also reported in the Hollywood Reporter, and it said the French drama Marguerite, which is a true story about a wealthy socialite. She tried to, I guess, enter the opera as a mezzo-soprano. It filled, as the Hollywood Reporter says, 264,000 seats across France, and actually beat out Straight Out of Compton.
two more different music-based films, it's hard to imagine.
Right, exactly. Now, Straight Out of Compton sold 220,000 tickets, to which I said, but how much did it make? Now, the Hollywood Reporter was kind enough to do the math for us, so Marguerite made roughly $1.9 million.
I did that. You had the average ticket price was $7.23, so I just multiplied 264 by it. That wasn't in your notes. Was that in the story?
No, it wasn't.
I'm the one who added in the $1.9 million. I said, well, what's $7.23 times 264,000 tickets?
Oh, okay.
So we did that, not them. They don't get the credit.
We get credit.
By the way, I love ticket sales. I wish that was the worldwide standard rather than box office. I'd love to talk about how many tickets were being sold.
And that's why I mentioned this story at all, is that they don't say it made $2 million or $3 million. They say, no, this was a popular film. 500,000 people went to see it.
Well, it's the number one film in France, right?
Right. In this
case. Or say it beat that movie, but it's at the top seller for the weekend, right?
Right, correct.
So it is the number one film in France, but it made $1.9 million, and that's not enough to break onto the worldwide chart. Even down at the bottom of number 19, you're still at $3.3 million. Obviously, we're not covering the top 40 or 50 films in the world, so we didn't get down to this movie. So there are other movies in other territories that are big successes in, you know, their home country of Sweden or wherever, but they're not grossing enough to break out and get onto the worldwide charts. So we love to know when there's a big hit in your country. Let us know. How do they do that, Sperling?
Actually, they can write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or they can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our username is @showbizsandbox. Or, you know, you can drop us a line through Facebook. We check that as well. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox on Facebook, our page should pop up.
Well, funnily enough, Marguerite, this French film, was about a true story about a wealthy socialite who wants to go into opera. And Meryl Streep has just finished filming Florence Foster Jenkins, which is a true story about a New York heiress who wanted to become an opera singer. She just finished filming it. It's a very famous story. And her husband kept wanting her to believe she was good. He didn't want to break her heart. And I think he arranged for a premiere to fill the audience and pay people to come and applaud and cheer his wife, you know. So she was always under the illusion that she was a great singer. It kind of reminds you of that scene in, what's that dark, dark drama? Ironweed, with her and Jack Nicholson.
Yes.
There's a heartbreaking scene in that movie where Meryl Streep sings. It's just heartbreaking. But how hilarious that there are two movies with the same storyline, one in France and now one in America.
Oh, that never happens. Never.
Yeah. But I mean, about this weird of a little tale.
That is true.
Yeah,
that is
and
true.
Of course,
now,
there was
also
one big flop. Mm-hmm. One big flop this week.
Oh, don't tell me you're talking about Stonewall.
Of course.
Okay. Yeah. You want to talk about this film?
Roland Emmerich, did his personal pet project about Stonewall, the gay uprising in New York City, that was sort of one of the symbolic steps in the modern fight for gay rights. And it opened on 129 screens and made $871 per screen dreadful, dreadful opening for the movie. It didn't help that it was wildly inaccurate historically, and people just are not going to stand for that anymore. You know, having kind of a white kid lead off Stonewall when it was a, at the time, you would have said a drag queen, just isn't going to fly anymore. People are not going to accept that. So it was just a misbegotten, if well-intentioned project.
People can like Wikipedia the thing from their movie seat.
Like, what?
Yeah.
So Adam Sandler has a comeback film, right?
Well,
Hotel Pennsylvania 2.
Blah, blah, blah.
But aren't people going to be talking about that? He's made a bunch of bad movies in a row. He's doing this Netflix thing. He's gotten bad press for one movie that he's filming called The Ridiculous Six. He's had a couple movies that have underperformed like Pixels. I'm like, oh, Adam Sandler, he needs to make a comeback, right? That's the storyline people are going
to
push.
I was just waiting to make that blah, blah, blah joke, because if you've ever seen Hotel Transylvania,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and he says, I don't say blah, blah, blah. And somebody says, you just did.
So, you know, if you look at his career, it's kind of fascinating. He really broke into the big time in 1996. Before that, he had Happy Gilmore and Yes, The Wedding Singer, which is one of his best films, if not his best. And then he really broke into the commercial big time in 96. And for the first decade, from 96 to 2005, he had six movies in North America that grossed $100 million or more. And since he makes movies very cheaply, you know, he's not making big action films, these are very profitable films. None of them made $100 million internationally. Now, since then, in 2006 to today, he's had nine films, almost a film a year, gross over $100 million in North America. I am including Hotel Transylvania 2 in that kitty because it will pass $100 million. All of them have made $100 million or more overseas. So he's a much bigger star today than he was 20 years ago or 10 years ago. Even though his movies are not very good recently, you know, he hasn't made a lot of good movies, they're making money.
So wait a second, has somebody written this story already?
No, this is just me saying, but as people start to say, oh, Adam Sandler's comeback, you know, whenever he has a live action film that's going to work, they're going to say, oh, he's made a comeback. And it's like, it's ridiculous. Why did Netflix make a deal with him? Because they see how popular he's become around the world. And it's happened in the last decade. I don't know why. The movies aren't very good. But by God, he's done it. I don't know whether he's doing press overseas or whether the movies he's making are just clicking with an international audience. And that began with Click, that remote control movie. That was his first one that made $100 million in the U.S. and $100 million overseas. That was in 2006. And virtually every year, he's had a big hit film. And so to talk about him needing a comeback is just so, you know, narrow-minded and stupid and wrong. That is just worth pointing out now, because you know you're going to be hearing that in the weeks and months to come.
Well, okay. I mean, I don't necessarily, I think maybe he needs a film that's good.
Well, that'd be nice creatively, but as a star, he doesn't need a comeback. Of course, you wanted to make good movies, but he hasn't made a lot of good movies, period.
Yeah,
you know, he has The Wedding Singer and Punch Drunk Love and The Wedding Singer. I mean, you know, Happy Gilmore is a funny golf comedy because there are only three in history. There's Caddyshack, Tin Cup, and Happy Gilmore. What else is there?
What about, you know, Billy Madison, where he goes back to school?
I don't think any of his other movies are good. Big Daddy is hard. You know, some of them are less offensive or less dumb than others. You know, Big Daddy and whatever, Billy Madison. That's the one where he goes back to school. Oh, God. You know, those movies are like, they're harmless, perhaps, as opposed to like the really dumb ones recently, like Grown Ups 2 or whatever. But they're not good. He's never made a lot of good movies.
Okay, I'm not arguing. I don't know if you're looking for me to
take. Why are you waiting for him to make a good movie? People are saying he's washed up. People hate Adam Sandler. He's run away to Netflix. Oh, he's in trouble. He's in trouble. Pixels underperformed. It's like one movie out of 10. You know, he's had a hit a year in the past decade, and they acted like Pixels was the end of his career.
Well, he may be washed up because he's living in his big mansion in Malibu. That's pretty much what he's saying is, yeah, okay, I'm washed up. I'm also making a fortune. Now, speaking of fortunes, since I just mentioned the word fortune, do you want to move on to the publishing news that we have? Because we have literally a plethora of publishing news. Do you see what I did there? Alliteration. Two P's.
I do.
I don't even know where you want to start, because like every other area of the entertainment industry, the book world has been rocked by the digital revolution. But things seem to be leveling out, and publishers feel maybe, just maybe, everything they know hasn't been upended yet. Here's the latest. And Michael, do you want to take this? You want me to? How do you want to do this?
Well, let me just start by saying the New York Times ran a story about ebook sales falling 10% in the first 5 months of this year, according to some stats.
Now, why? Let me ask you, because I saw that and I was wondering, why are ebook sales falling? Because I would have thought that ebooks would dominate. I mean, Look, I was on the subway in New York, and everybody with their little Kindles and their iPhones and their iPads, they're all reading. I don't know what they're doing. Maybe, hey, you know, Avenue Q, I think was the name of that Broadway show. They said the internet was for porn. Maybe that's what they're doing. I don't know, but it looks like they're reading books.
Well, they are. I can't tell you how many people talked about this article. It's a New York Times story, big business news story. I have to say, I immediately was tearing it apart as being misleading and not getting the full picture and all that. And everybody in the publishing industry has weighed in as well. Even though they want to hear that print is coming back and blah, 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 they recognize that this article didn't really tell a proper or full story. And there was a lot of coverage of this article and taking it down a notch and explaining why it's misleading or wrong or just isn't capturing the full picture. So we are not the first by any stretch of the imagination. And as I was talking to people, they said, well, why is ebook sales falling? There's like a dozen reasons you could give. But the biggest number one reason why ebook sales are falling is because they probably aren't.
Well, wait a second. Is this because like there's some people not reporting their sales?
Right. The New York Times reported on figures from the Association of American Publishers. And that reps like 1,000 plus publishers, all the big publishers and all that. The two, as they mentioned towards the end of the article, the one area they're not covering is Amazon.
Oh, well, okay.
And Amazon sales are hard to track. Some of the publishers would get their info from Amazon because they're obviously selling books through Amazon. But Amazon handles self-published authors. And the biggest area of growth, the biggest area of snibbling away at these guys is self-published authors who are not included in this figure at all. And Amazon says, well, yeah, our sales are going up. You know, our sales figures are on a straight upward trajectory. So we don't know what they've done in self-published sales. We don't know how big of a pie it is, and we don't know how it's grown from last year to this year. So looking at just the publishers and ignoring the self-published authors just doesn't tell the full story.
And by the way, you want to know why self-published authors matter? The Martian, that book, originally self-published.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's true.
And 50 Shades of Grey, originally self-published. So
Twilight, self-published. Lots of books.
So here's my question, because I think what, they roughly have 65%? Of the ebook market, Amazon, that is? They have 65%?
I can't believe it's that's what I saw recently, but that seems low. Because so, with the web free fall for Barnes & Noble, it's probably even bigger.
So in the first 5 months of 2015, because I'm going to rewrite this headline for the New York Times to make it more accurate, okay? In the first 5 months of 2015, ebook sales fell 10% if you only count 45% of the market.
Well, 35%, but no, 30, some of yes. That some of those sales are covered by the publishers because they would know what they sold at Amazon.
Okay, all right.
But Amazon includes self-published authors, and that's where all the area of growth is. It also doesn't include ebook subscriptions and other things like Amazon Kindle Unlimited and all that other stuff.
I suppose that's why I don't work for the New York Times, because I couldn't rewrite their headline. But will we ever know what sales are like over at Amazon, or they're just never going to tell us?
I don't think we're going to know. I mean, they don't have any reason to tell us, and I don't think they're going to tell us. So unless you have individual authors coming forward, like you do in some self-published people, like Hugh Howie, they come forward and they say, here's what I've done. Here's what it looks like. And they analyze all these different metrics to try and figure out what the market as a whole is doing. So, you know, did ebook sales fall for the first 10% the first 5 months of 2015 for traditional publishers? Yes, they did. Now we want to know, why is that?
Well, and let me ask you this, because when I was in New York, of course, I had to go by one store, Michael. And you know what store that is.
That's got to be the Strand, right?
Oh, I was talking about FAO Schwartz. I don't know. But
they're gone.
I was like, that joke would have been funny if they too hadn't closed. But Shakespeare and Company, gone. At least yes. Gone from the Village. But I did notice that there were all these bookstores, and the Strand just happens to be, you know, its big tagline is 18 miles of books. It's a huge bookstore. It's like Powell's in Oregon. It's there are bookstores in London and Paris that are the same, the huge, giant bookstores. They sell used books to new books and books in other languages. They're huge. But bookstores, there's Barnes & Noble's is still around. There are still bookstores out there. Why are they still there? When I walked by the old Tower Records building, I noticed it was not there.
And
when
a furniture store.
Right. And when I walked by Disco. Yeah. I walked by Discorama, where I used to buy records over on, I think it was West 4th Street. It's no longer there, but Bleecker Street Records has moved in. So record stores collapsed. Bookstores kind of going through the same thing, but haven't collapsed. What's going on there?
Well, Barnes & Noble is still around because they're making money selling games and toys and stationery and diaries. They're not making new money selling books. They still sell books, but that is not where their growth is. So they're holding on by their fingernails, because they're expanding into areas that don't include books.
Okay.
So that's not good news. The indie stores are around, but if you look at 20 years ago, 10 years ago, compared to today, there was a big collapse in independent bookstores. We have not gone back to what our peak levels were, not even close. So now we're at a new normal and they're holding steady. But what you see is like a chain, like Borders going out of business. And you see some big independent bookstores that have been around a long time going out of business. And they're being replaced by these tiny little stores with tiny little footprints in boutique neighborhoods. And people help them put books on the shelves. So you're getting a big store replaced with a tiny store that doesn't have nearly the same impact, doesn't carry the same amount of books, doesn't make the same amount of sales. So it's not equivalent. You know, one store closes, another opens. That's not the same when you see the new store that opens is practically a community center done nonprofit compared to an actual store making lots of money.
Okay.
So, you know, those are just, you're comparing apples. And the main idea is print was never going to go away in the blink of an eye. Most books that have been published throughout history are not available as ebooks. So the idea that there was this tug of war between print and ebook, oh, ebook's going to vanquish print. Well, all the time I hear about books I want to read. They're not available as ebooks. You can want to read Dr. Seuss or Where the Wild Things Are with your kid. You can do it on a tablet, but you're probably not going to. Art books, coffee, there are all sorts of categories of books that make sense in print and don't work as well or not at all in ebooks. So print wasn't going away. It was stupid to think it was. But when you look at ebooks and you look at new releases in big genres like mystery and sci-fi and literary fiction, ebook is dominating.
Well, now, okay, so we're talking about ebooks, but there was this, I thought maybe the whole ebook thing was because of this Apple lawsuit. There wasn't a lawsuit that Apple...
Well, the federal government investigated.
Right. And publishers are now being held to certain rules where they are, I guess, they're now free to charge what they want, if I'm not
right.
mistaken.
Right. They made an agreement with the government. They said, all right, you know, we'll admit our we colluded and we set, even though they insist they didn't, and we admit we colluded and we were setting prices and we'll agree to abide by these new rules you set for several years. And they had sort of a cascading series of deadlines where like this company started this day and that company started 3 months later and so on as they all made deals. And now all those deals are gone. They're now free to set their prices again individually without colluding any way they want.
And what are they doing?
They're raising ebook prices.
Okay, that's what I thought they would do. Okay. But then let me ask you this, because, okay, this was what I mentioned at the head of the show. Why the heck do I go on to, okay, I'll admit it, I go on to Amazon, and I'll look at some ebook price, or some book, it doesn't matter what book it is, and it's like $15 for the ebook, and it's $12 to get the book physically, whether, usually it's paperback.
Yeah,
usually it's paperback. What the heck is going on there?
I have no idea. They're just being idiots. It's like, you know, some people say ebooks should be a lot cheaper because it's so much cheaper for them. Well, you know, you're really buying the book. So there's two ideas here. Are you buying the format or are you just buying the thing? When you buy a movie, when you buy Casablanca, you're not buying a VHS tape or a DVD or a Blu-ray or a digital. You're buying Casablanca. And to you, it's worth $10. So when you're buying a book, you know, yeah, there are different advantages and disadvantages of all these different formats. But essentially, you want to read the new Stephen King. And if you want to read it now, you're going to buy it on hardcover or ebook. If you're willing to wait a year, you're going to buy it on paperback. But the basic idea is, you know, you want to read that new book by Stephen King. And when it's available in the format you want, you pay for it. But it's not about paying for an ebook or paying for, you're just wanting to read the book, right? So the price should kind of be the same. You know, you don't pay less just because ebooks are cheaper to produce. You know, that doesn't make sense. Well, it should only be $5 because they're cheaper. They don't have to make copies.
No, you're paying for you're paying
the creative
for intellectual
talent and
property.
The artwork that went into it and the thing. Right. But ebooks are cheaper to make than paperback. So once it's out in paperback, the idea that a paperback would be $12, an ebook would be more expensive. That's just nutty. That's just
Are they asking you to pay for the convenience of being able to take 500 books with you?
They're kind of just being pissy, and they're reacting to the fact that that Amazon forced them for years to sell ebooks at $10 a pop, even if they wanted to sell them at the same price as their paperback and make it $12 a pop. So they had to discount books, and now they don't have to. Like, fine, you're going to pay more. You know, there's no conceivable good business reason to charge more for an ebook because there are so many disadvantages to it. You can't resell it. You can't loan it to friends. You can't give it away. You can't donate it to the library. You can't put it on your shelf. So why you would pay more is beyond me. And they're just being stupid, and I think this is one of the big reasons new big bestsellers are the biggest drivers of sales for new bookstores. So when you see sales dropping 10% over this period by the publishers that we're talking about, one reason is the big titles like The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, or All the Light You Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, are being charged more for ebooks. People who might have bought one, pause. And
well,
then
okay.
Why the hell should I pay more for an ebook?
So just let me ask this. I mean, I remember Amazon saying, look, here's why we charge $9.95. We have tens of millions of customers, okay? And we've done some A-B testing with some of these people where we give one price to one person and another price to person B. And you know what? We found that $9.95, we actually sell a significantly higher number of books, okay? You will sell 10% less if you start charging $12.95, $14.95, $15.95 for these books. And sure enough, they're selling 10% less.
Well, the problem was that they were selling ebooks the same day hardcover came out. And now in Europe, I believe, in a number of countries, when a book comes out, it is available in hardcover and paperback on the same day. The new Stephen King comes out in some countries, I believe. You say, oh, you want the hardcover or you want the paperback? It's a little bit less because it's not as fancy and whatever, so you pay less.
Right.
But publisher had never done that here in the U.S. And the book was coming out in a hardcover, and it was, you know, a $25 list price, maybe $15 or $17 discount on sale. But on ebook, it was $10. Well, people said, well, the hell with, why am I going to buy $17 for the hardcover? I'll get the ebook for $10. That's a big difference. That's a big price difference. And that helped power the ebook, powered Kindle sales, sold people on ebooks, but it was a discount that happened too soon. You know, either hardcover should be less or they should be bundled together. Whatever's going on, it was just a distortion of the market. So you had the moment the book was out, you had a huge discount on ebooks that nobody else could match. And when Barnes & Noble tried to match it, it worked, but they lost money on every sale. And that's why you had this all big collusion between Apple and all. You know, they're like, my God, we're losing money every time we sell a copy of a book on ebook. So it was a nightmare, you know, and they were unhappy with the fact that ebooks were so deeply discounted and available the same day as the hardcover. So it created this weird perception of people like, I shouldn't pay more than $10 for a book. Well, no, that's not necessarily right. But they had no choice. They couldn't adjust. They couldn't say, all right, we'll charge this for the ebook when the hardcover comes out, and then we'll lower it a year later when we put the paperback out. Or they didn't bundle stuff. They didn't do a lot of smart things that they might have tried because Amazon didn't give them a choice. And they're afraid and they believe that that poisoned people into thinking books should not cost more than $10.
Okay, well, we got people in the subway sitting next to me reading on their Kindles, reading on their phones, reading on their iPads, reading on their iPhone, all the devices. You'd think this would help the industry out a little bit, right? I mean, you'd think more people are reading more books than ever. Is that actually the case or what's going on?
Well, they do. They think that the move to a larger size phone that Apple has finally caved into and had done very successfully. By the way, the new iPhone just sold $13 million on its opening weekend. I mean, 13 million units on its opening weekend. A new record, but nobody seems to care, right? It's like they're like, oh, the new iPhone is boring. And then it sells another record. But anyway, yeah, more people have got their phones with them. It's a larger size and they're using it as a reading device. Mobile reading has migrated from the dedicated e-reader to the tablet and now perhaps to the plus-sized phone. People are reading on their phone a lot. And does that help the industry? I think it's actually hurt them. I think the switch to tablets and phones has hurt the industry because when people had dedicated e-readers, they were actually reading. When you're on your phone and you're reading, oh, you get a text. Oh, you get a call. Oh, you get this. Oh, you go online. And I think it's made the reading experience a lot less focused, a lot less effective, and a lot less pleasurable. You're constantly being interrupted by the book you're reading. You know, when you're reading a hardcover book, it doesn't bleep at you. When you're reading on a tablet or a phone, you're getting interrupted all the time. And I think that's a long-term problem. And I think that's one reason there has been a downtick in sales in the last few months because people are reading on their phone and you're less likely to do it.
Well, if everybody's reading more, okay, and where they're reading on smaller devices. Here's my question, actually. This is really what I wanted to get to, is there are all these services, Oyster and Kindle Unlimited and all these subscription services. Are they working out? Because I don't subscribe to any of them. But
well, they're going bust. Oyster just went bankrupt. They were bought out by Google. And Google made a big point of saying, we are not going to relaunch Oyster. Okay. They're like, no. We're bringing those people in. We bought their intellectual property. But don't wait for Oyster to come back. It's being shut down. It's gone. Entidle was another big one. They went bankrupt a few months ago. Scribd is the third big player. They just cut back on their all-you-can-eat model. They're saying, yeah, not so much. Too many of you people are reading like 1,000 romance novels a month and we're losing money left and right. So will it ever catch on? I don't think so.
So basically, subscription membership models, like, say, gyms, you know, they work when there's a hurdle in the way, like, oh, I actually have to go to the gym to work out. And I don't really necessarily want to, or I don't have the time. But when you can just sit in your living room and order up another book, that doesn't work.
That's true. People like to have a gym membership, and they perhaps would like the idea of subscribing to any book they can have. But the difference is that you might go to the gym every day, or if you subscribe to a movie library like Netflix, a TV library, or music library, people listen to albums all the time. They watch two or three movies a week, maybe. They watch TV shows hours and hours every day. People do not read a book a day. They don't read a book a week. Most people do not have the need to read more than one book a month. They don't read 12 books a year. It takes a lot longer. It's more of a, you know, it's more of a commitment. And so while going to the gym for half an hour is not a big commitment, and you may mentally say, I could do that. Nobody thinks, I'm going to read 4 books this week. I mean, I do, but most people don't. So the idea of paying $10 or $20 a month so you can read, what, a book a week? 95% of the people are never going to do that. So I just don't see why they would ever sign up. The only people who sign up are the people who read like 3 books a week. And they are incredibly aggressive readers, and the numbers just will never work out for them. So it just isn't a profitable business, because the only people who will sign up for you are the heavy, heavy, heavy users. So to me, it doesn't work.
And will they ever catch on?
I don't know. No, they won't. There are tweaks on it, like Cereal Box. This is sort of an interesting thing, isn't it? It's not an ebook subscription thing, but they're saying, hey, people used to serialize novels in magazines. They were written to be serialized. Dickens wrote serializations. He didn't write a novel. He wrote a 27-part serial that people read every week or month in their newspaper or magazine. And they said, let's create content that's serialized, like science fiction and thrillers. We'll have teams of people, just like on TV. We'll create a season where it tells one long story, but it'll be digital and it'll be books rather than radio or TV. We'll just create properties, just like a TV show, and have a team of writers do it. And it'll be delivered every week in text or audio formats that people will subscribe and they'll love it. Does it sound interesting?
I don't know. You know what? I'm waiting for the movie.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess that would be a big deal if they turned one of these into a movie, though, wouldn't it?
It's time for Big Deal, Big Whoop.
That's right. It is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. You're not really going to make me sing this, are you?
Of course.
You know, we have listeners, right?
Keep going.
Should I sing it as Marilyn Monroe?
No, or sing it as Sperling.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Michael.
It's not my birthday. It's not my birthday.
I don't care, actually, because you know what? If I could sing, I would be singing that song all the time, because that song is now in the public domain.
Yay!
And I'm going to sing it, damn it. Well, I'm not. I might ask somebody else to do it, because as you can see, I don't really sing. But a judge ruled that Happy Birthday, a song written by two school teachers in the late 1800s, mind you, is now, in fact, in the public domain. Apparently, when you write a song 200 years ago, it eventually hits the public domain. They didn't even try to copyright the melody until 40 years after they wrote it. A federal judge says they never tried to copyright the lyrics, and it's not even clear they assigned the rights to the melody, but just the piano arrangement and sheet music rights. That was back in 1935, by the way. Now, anyone can sing it, except apparently me. But the lawsuits won't end. Plaintiffs say the publisher owes millions for unduly collected rights. Big deal or big whoop?
The big whoop.
What? After all of that, you may be singing and everything. That's it.
Because nothing has changed, and it's a special case because of how the rights were assigned, and it was a torturous path, and people had to go to court to do it. So nothing has changed about the absurd situation of copyright and how long things stay out of the public domain. And this hasn't changed that. This is not a breakthrough ruling that is going to change the absurd practices that we have right now. And until that happens, it will remain a big whoop.
Commentator Ta-Nehisi Coates has been called the new James Baldwin, the new conscience of America. Now he's being called the new Stan Lee. Yes, Coates has talked often about his love of comic books, and now he's being brought on board a reboot of Black Panther. His run is set to start in the spring of 2016. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, it's a big whoop, I guess. You know, guy gets job, but he's incredibly talented. He hasn't done fiction like this, so it'll be fascinating to see how well he does. A lot of other big names have jumped into the comic book world at times. You know, I'm fascinated to see what he'll do with it. And if you're a Black Panther fan, of course, then it is a big deal.
What is it with you and the songs?
You don't have to sing that one.
Oh, what a night. Okay, that's the Broadway musical Jersey Boys. They hit a new milestone this week. The show that has been the safe choice when trying to convince musical-wary men to check out a Broadway show just delivered its 4,093rd performance of Sherry, Walk Like a Man, and other hits by Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. That passes Miss Saigon to make Jersey Boys the 12th longest-running hit in Broadway history. Unfortunately, that's as high as the show will probably get, since Wicked is just ahead of it and is still going strong, and Jersey Boys would have to run another 3 years to pass the current top 10 hit, Rent. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal anytime a show gets that high up on the charts. It's not easy. We've just had two new ones enter the 1,000 or more performances, which is really the benchmark for a blockbuster, and those were Matilda and Kinky Boots. Those are probably going to end, you know, in a year or two. This show to last another 3 years, I don't think it'll do it, but stranger things have happened, I guess.
That's true. And I mean, after being in New York again over the weekend, it's really hard for a show to last. I mean, look at Something Rotten. It's a good show. It's not a bad show. It's not as good as Hamilton. But you know what? It's been a year, roughly. It's going to be going for what? I think it opened in March, right?
Right.
So it's going to struggle to get to a year, right?
Yeah. I mean, it could very well be profitable once all is said and done with international and touring. So it doesn't mean it will be a flop commercially, but it's certainly not going to have a 2.5 year run.
Exactly. Sports Illustrated wants to take on ESPN. So Time Inc. is expanding its original video content by launching SI Films. They're going to create 6 new sports features, presumably documentaries of some sort, to bow on SI.com as original content. The kids love their video, apparently. They'll do in-house films as well as material from outside, though it's unclear if all material must originate with them or they're in the market for sports-related work. Big deal or big whoop?
Sounds like a big whoop to me. Have they ever done any films? Are they any good? You know, this is not your wheelhouse. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, but it ain't easy. So suddenly jumping into video, we're going to make videos too. Well, all right, make a good one and then we can talk.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if they will be viewable by international audiences. So some of our international listeners and,
I don't see why not. If they're creating stuff for their website, unless they say subscribers only or something like that. But if they want to reach, you know, they can make it available to the world if they want.
That's true. I know one thing that was available to the world. This next story. Because you really don't want to piss off Joe Pesci. At least you don't want to piss off the infamous character he created in Goodfellas. That movie is a Martin Scorsese classic. According to Warner Brothers, however, it's also a flop, a movie that has never made a penny in profit. Producer Irwin Winkler says, nonsense. Actually, he used a stronger word, and you can hear that word about 1,000 times in the movie Goodfellas. Winkler says the movie cost about $30 million to make and has grossed $275 million worldwide. Saying it's in the red is Hollywood accounting on steroids, and that on steroids is his words, not ours. He says, and he's hired lawyer Burt Fields to prove it, big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop because we can probably predict that this will get settled out of court before they actually get to trial and we get to see the nitty-gritty details, right?
That is absolutely true.
However, it's kind of fascinating because this is not the type of movie that usually gets to this stage. Because this movie cost $25 to $30 million to make. Its North American gross when it came out was $46 million. We don't have any figures for what it grossed around the world, but that was not that long ago, 1990. But nonetheless, there was less pushing of movies overseas. You got less figures and less box office around the world. It hadn't developed as much as it has today. So where does this $275 million figure come from? Does that include DVD and Blu-ray and cable and video? You know, what is he including in there? And how did he come up with that number? And if this movie is profitable, a movie that cost $30 million to make and only made $46 million in North America, and you can see, oh, that's a valuable piece of their library over all these 25 years. 25 years. Wow. Think about all the other movies that are profitable. That on paper, we look and go, well, that doesn't look like it made a lot of money, right? $30 million to make and only grossed $46 million. You know, you don't think there's tons of money in that, but there is.
There is.
That's why Woody Allen and Martin Scorsese were making movie after movie after movie, despite not having huge box office, because they were valuable additions to your library.
Well, and if you look at it, you know, what he's claiming here is that Warner Brothers Home Video, which released Goodfellas on, you know, all of its ancillary
sure.
home video markets, basically took money, gave of the $275 million, said, oh, okay, here you go, Warner Brothers Pictures. Here's $25 million for, you know, the home video.
Here's our fee.
Yeah. a huge fee. It was like some like $30 million fee, I think. And they then slowly, since it was a subsidiary, kind of pocketed the rest as profits for Warner Brothers Home Video.
When there's also, I don't think it ends there. There's cable sales and TV sales and syndication sales and worldwide TV sales. That's why you never hear dollar, you rarely hear dollar figures, you're about to in a minute, for DVD and Blu-ray sales or VHS in the old days, or what TV shows and movies have sold around the world, you know, for TV and satellite and cable. We don't get those numbers. They never discuss those numbers because there's a lot of money there and they don't want actors and people waking up and saying, hey, wait a second, I want a piece of that pie.
Yeah, right. Especially after 15 years.
25.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, God, it's been 25 years. Yikes.
Okay. You're old.
That is very true. Now, Amy Schumer just put on her bossy pants. This year, she's won an Emmy for her sketch comedy TV show. She's starred in a hit comedy movie that she co-wrote. And now she's received a $9 million advance for a comic memoir about her life and feminist politics. You know what's really funny is a 20-year-old writing a memoir. But anyway, Simon & Schuster.
20?
I'm just kidding. Simon & Schuster was the winning publisher.
Sexist.
Oh my God, I would have said that about a young guy too. Simon & Schuster, they, I guess it was.
It would be funny if she actually was young.
How old is she? She's like in her 20s.
She is, in fact, she was born in 1981. So she's what, 34?
Okay, so she looks young. What do you want from me? What I do like, though, you know, Simon & Schuster won this bidding war. The book is called The Girl with the Lower Back Tattoo. That I thought was kind of funny. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's a big deal because it's a big gamble. That's a lot of money for a memoir.
That is true. You
know?
Yeah.
Did they make money on Lena Dunham? I don't know. She certainly sold hundreds of thousands of copies. Did she sell millions? Because when you're paying $9 million for the book, you're going to have to sell a lot of copies to make your money back.
Universal touted the home entertainment debut of Fast and Furious 7 as big news. They say it sets records for the studio and is already the highest grossing live action film in home entertainment sales for the year, with some $52 million since coming out September 15th. The film has sold 2.5 million units of DVD and Blu-ray. That total dollar amount also includes digital downloads, but not apparently VOD. Furious 7 is already the highest grossing title in sell-through for the franchise, and they predict it will be the studio's all-time champ. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it seems like a big whoop. These numbers don't make any sense to me. They're saying no movie that Universal released ever. I mean, that seems low, doesn't it? $52 million? It used to be you could make half or the same of your box office on VHS and DVD back in the glory days. But sure, don't they have some movies back in the glory days that opened to bigger numbers than this?
Well, I would imagine Jurassic Park.
This is a billion-dollar movie.
Right, and it's
Jurassic Park is a billion-dollar movie, and it's only making $50 million? I know it's just so far, but nonetheless, that seems piddling.
And I would think Jurassic World, which will be out later this year, will surpass it, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, no, I don't understand how this is setting records. You know, it's their fifth highest-grossing film of all time, $1.5 billion, and they're saying, we sold $50 million. It's like, well, big deal.
Well, in 1 week, that is a lot. In 1 week. Now, talk to me at the end of the year, at the end of the quarter, how much did you make?
Right. Why not include video on demand and rental and everything else and streaming? I mean, we want to know what the movie made.
Well, I can tell you exactly why they don't.
Because they don't want to talk about the money it's making.
That's right. Because if they could, they would not talk about box office. Okay.
They would just want to say we're the number one movie.
Right. Exactly. Well, we made the most money. Trust us. You know, they don't want to talk about necessarily how much money it's making when, somebody's going to come with their handout saying, well, you owe me some of that money. Hmm. Certainly, they don't want to do that. They don't want to make a habit of doing it on VOD. Wolf Hall, The Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby, Angels in America, and now we can add Harry Potter. Yes, the origin story of the boy who didn't die is coming to the West End of London as a play. And now J.K. Rowling has tweeted out that they'll be presenting it in not one, but two parts. John Tiffany of Once is directing, and it's opening next summer. The news was detailed more on the website Pottermore. The thoroughly revamped official Harry Potter website can be found at pottermore.com. Big deal or big whoop?
If only they were advertising with us. It's a big deal, for God's sakes, woman. Get an editor. it's like her last books were like 800-900 pages long, and they were not as good as the early ones. Once people got afraid to, work with her to phone and 2-part? Oh my God. But, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing it. And Pottermore, by the way, that was a big change. It actually is a cool looking site. They changed it from the way it was originally conceived, and they were very scared to do it, and like, we thought long and hard, but they're now making it more a source for the whole Harry Potter world rather than just reading the books. And it's not like one linear adventure where you work your way through the website and solve puzzles and things and move on to the next step. Now it's like a whole place, and you can get news and you can experience it all at once, even if you're just a casual user. You don't have to be a hardcore Potter maniac to do it. So it was a big overhaul, and it's a very nice looking site.
Steven Spielberg will be moving his operations, well, probably to Universal. We're not sure, but it definitely soon. I know it's Universal. I can put my money down on Universal because that's where his offices are right now.
Yeah, it's Universal.
Insiders say Universal. It's been a deal that's been about a year and a half in the making. That gives him until January, though, to January 1st, that is, to decide if he wants to keep licensing the DreamWorks name from the Jeffrey Katzenberg offshoot DreamWorks Animation, to which I say, what? The company is in hibernation of sorts, trying to figure out its financials while it gears up for 2 feature films a year, starting with Kung Fu Panda 3, and that's DreamWorks Animation. That movie comes out, what is it, in January?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Spielberg could presumably keep the dream of his own studio nominally alive or just refocus on Amblin Entertainment, the logo he uses for his contribution to a host of other projects like Jurassic World and the upcoming Bridge of Spies. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, right? You know, what name appears on the logo on the screen before your movie starts? That's the sum total of it. It's interesting that DreamWorks Animation has the rights to it.
Yeah, well, I think
I don't know how that happened in the split up. Why he didn't just get the rights to his own thing for his own live action version. Why they had to keep paying DreamWorks Animation, but whatever.
Well, because DreamWorks Animation is a public company, so they probably needed to secure the name DreamWorks and the name DreamWorks Animation. So they needed that.
You don't have to be a public company to do that. Well, yeah. Don't lots of companies have rights to their own name without having to be public or not public? I mean, what's that got to do with anything?
Well, I think that was part of, they wanted to secure that. So, and DreamWorks was not a public company, and they could just take any name they wanted. It's always been confusing. I think it's always confused a lot of people, the DreamWorks versus DreamWorks Animation split, and that they're not the same company anymore. I think the Hollywood Reporter kind of mentioned that for Spielberg, it would kind of be like admitting, gee, that whole DreamWorks thing never really worked out.
I don't say, I mean, they lasted for 20 years. They create a lot of movies they're proud of. Big deal. Like, you act like, oh, you failed. It's like, no. They created a company. They launched a lot of movies, many of which they're proud of. And now, you know, things don't necessarily last forever. You know, so what? It's not a mission of failure. It's just hey, we gave it the old college try, and we had a lot of great movies we're proud of. You know, well, that's not a signal of failure. You know, that's such a negative thing. It's like, oh, your company's not lasting for 200 years. You failed. You know, it's like, no, they tried. It didn't work.
Oh, well, then.
Or they worked for years and now they've moved on.
Well, we consider it a failure if our show doesn't last an hour and a half each week.
Oh, well, success.
Exactly. So we should move on to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, there's, I guess, a number of stories, some of which are about you, some of which will affect you, some of which will affect some folks in Spain, maybe, or we're not doing the Netflix moves to Spain story, are we?
It's not. They're going to Spain.
No, they're going to Spain. Okay, but first off, let's start off in the world of ratings. Because, well, first off, I need to know, before we go on, who won the Yankee game last night? Because I was on a plane. I took off. The Yankees were playing.
Oh, okay, in the third inning, Sperling, the score was
Wait. I don't necessarily want to know the score in the third inning. I want to know who actually won the game, okay? Which is why you don't report who's ahead in the third inning as if it's the final score of the game, right?
Yep.
Well, now, my question is, when will TV learn that lesson? Because many networks and the media, mostly the media, trumpet overnight ratings. But in fact, those are useless in determining which shows are watched the most. The overnight showed Scream Queens, for instance, debuting very softly last week. But once you added in DVR and a record amount of streaming on Hulu, suddenly Scream Queens had gone from, like, say, 4 million viewers for its debut episode to 7 million. It nearly doubled it. It leapfrogged over several other shows like Fresh Off the Boat and Limitless and the Neil Patrick Harris Show. And that's not even the final story, since those are just the live plus 3 numbers, not live plus 7. Will anyone remember who won the night when the actual final score is tallied? Will anybody listen to the final score? Or will they just remember the Scream Queens or whatever it's called? It opened poorly.
Yes. No, this is a big problem. I really think overnight ratings and the way it's reported in the media is broken. We had Ann Thompson, who's a very smart person, on last week. And because she read in the New York Times, the Times said the overnight ratings for HBO's Game of Thrones were 6 million. And so she naturally assumed, oh, that's the number of people that watch the show. The New York Times didn't explain to her, wait a second, that's just like the equivalent to the Friday gross for a movie. You know, we can't extrapolate that, you know, from that to the weekend the way we do in movies. But when you do, when all is said and done, looking at last season, Game of Thrones is watched by 18 million people. So saying it was watched by 6 million is confusing and misleading. And most of the public is hearing just that first number. For Scream Queens, they had a great launch. But what people heard was they had a bad launch. Now, I was blaming the networks. But Sperling, you blame the media, don't you?
Well, I think that in this new world, I think the network executives are learning and for the most part have learned how to talk about ratings and how to talk about viewership. Some of the old guard may still be learning and struggling with it, but because the overnights were an institution. That's right. The way you lived. You lived and died by the overnights. If 5 million people tuned in overnight, that was your viewership. But networks in general and on par have begun to realize, no, it's not 4 million people overnight. It's 7 million people overall.
And that's not even overall. That's live plus 3. They still have another 4 days to quantify how many people watch the first episode before the next episode airs.
And more you're seeing that the networks are saying the average viewership per episode is X million people. And
right.
So they're saying
they can. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that way they don't report on a single episode or whether things it's trending up. They do when it trends up. Yes. But when they want you to know when you're advertising on this show, you're getting an average viewership of 10 million people that you're speaking to, Mr.
Well,
Advertiser.
Those ads are not on all categories necessarily, though,
true,
of course.
True, yes.
But nonetheless, that's how popular the show is. For example, Empire, that came back. The overnights, 16 million people watched. It was almost a new record for the show as far as where it was doing last season, where every week it opened to overnights bigger than the week before. The new season, I predicted it would do that. It would set a new record. It didn't quite in the overnights. Now, with Live Plus 3 and Hulu, it's up to 22.5 million. Still not quite the record. That's kind of where it was right at the end of last year. But still, obviously, you know, if it's peaked to 22 million viewers a week, that's pretty great. We still have 4 more days to find out how many people watched that episode. So the story isn't even done yet for Empire. But what they started off with was, 16 million people watched. It was great. Well, that's not as good as 24 million, is it?
No. And I mean, I guess when, you know, 60 million people is great, which is why they, you know, that you have the network and certainly the media.
If you're up 7-0 in the sixth inning, that's great news. But I want to know the final score. And I think the media has to learn you got to wait a week.
Yeah.
You know, no one's going to report the data 5 days in a row for the episode for Scream Queens, you know, debut. So you won't know. You can't know until people have had a week to watch it. So you have to wait till next week to report how many people watch Scream. You cannot do it in advance.
Well, in a world of instant gratification, okay, and in a world where the media has been trained to look at the overnights, they all have subscriptions to Nielsen. Nielsen is a business. They're not going to stop reporting overnights because that's how they make their money.
They didn't used to have overnights, and they didn't used to have that information, and they didn't used to report on how many people watched Live Plus 3, and they didn't used to report, you know, things change. You know, you didn't used to know.
But they don't always change fast.
Report on Friday what the weekend box office would be, but they know by Friday afternoon whether it's going to probably make by Sunday night.
Right.
That didn't used to be possible. So things change. Now things are changing back again. You cannot report on, you can't accurately report the audience for a TV show 17 hours after it aired. You can't, especially a new show like Scream Queens, where you go, well, it's a lot of young people probably. They're more likely to DVR it. And are they going to wait 2 or 3 days or 5 days? You know, there's no pattern to base it on based on last year. So you have to wait.
Well,
and
I think it's mostly.
They're shooting themselves in the foot. You know, they're way underreporting what is happening in television.
Well, I don't think it's the network so much. As we know, HBO does not want overnights reported. Many networks are not reporting overnights anymore because they don't want that known, because they realize, like you, that is not the true audience.
So what's happening? How are these numbers getting out?
I think because, like I mentioned, in a world where, you know, you have to be first as a reporter, I think the media outlets that have their Nielsen subscriptions are immediately going out there and reporting it. And those bloggers and those media analysts are all kind of racing to their WordPress websites and saying, oh, you know, the 16 million Empire debut. And you
or
know,
6
what?
Million overnight for Game of Thrones, which is grotesquely underreporting.
Right.
Or 8 million for Walking Dead. Or not, you know, that's grotesquely underreporting the audience for those shows.
And then in the fall, next fall, or in some piece that they do down the line, they will kind of have the average viewership for a single episode of a particular series. They'll kind of not necessarily correct themselves, but say, on average, Game of Thrones is watched by 20 million people.
Yeah. So maybe they should all be like Netflix and never report ratings.
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, Netflix didn't necessarily report ratings this past week, but what they did say is, guys, you know, in the industry, primetime television, everything is about the pilot. You know, you focus so much attention on the pilot, but we did this what we call a hook study to figure out when are our customers, our subscribers actually hooked on a series? What episode is it? And it's not the first and rarely the second. It's often, you know, the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, all the way up to the eighth episode when their subscribers say, oh, I'm going to watch the full series.
So what they mean is, at what point did the audience stop dropping?
Correct.
I guess. So they're saying, you know, 8 million people watched the first episode, 5 million watched the second, 4 million watched the third, and then 4 million watched the fourth, fifth, sixth, you know.
So then
that number plateaued, stayed where it was, and throughout the end of the run, basically. That's what they're talking about, right?
Correct.
Right. So they did a study, didn't they?
They did. They call it the hook study.
And it sounds about as stupid as possible.
Well, I mean,
First of all, they studied 24 shows. 24? They've got like thousands of shows and years of data that they could crunch.
Well, and they're only doing first seasons. So that's another thing. They only did the first seasons
of 24 shows. It's not just their own original shows. It's like licensed content as well. So they could do the first season of whatever, right?
And I don't think they did any local content. I could be wrong about that, but it looks like they only did English language content, and they did it in countries like Brazil, Belgium, Canada, Ireland, Mexico. So I don't...
And the U.S. Yeah.
And the U.S., yeah.
And they did, some of them they studied from January to July of 2015. Others they studied from April to July of 2015. That was in Australia and New Zealand. And I'm saying, okay, they did just 24 shows. They were looking at just this one period. Why winter, you know, and why summer in Australia and New Zealand?
Because winter, no, summer in Australia and New Zealand is winter here.
Wait, sorry.
Why? You know,
well, I don't think they care about the outside weather. Why January to July for some countries and April to July for other countries? Why not, you know, is that a season where competition is low? Because obviously in the fall, you got a lot of new shows, so that would affect the data.
Well, they didn't really give their methodology, if that's what you're saying. I agree.
Well, but the methodology they give seems like nonsense. Why just 24 shows? Why in alternating time periods in different parts of the world? What are they facing locally? Why not a year of study? Why, you know, and how many episodes did each show have? Do they all have the same number of episodes? Because that doesn't make sense. Some had 12 episodes, some had 20, some had 14, some had 8. So the idea of committing to a show that you know is 20 episodes long is perhaps different than a show that is only 12 episodes long or 6 episodes long or 8 episodes. You know, all these different factors come into it and you're like, well, this just sounds stupid.
Well, let me put some words in your mouth here, okay? Uh-huh. I think what you're saying is this study is not going to change the way television gets made and how television gets programmed and what gets made, okay? What this really serves to prove, this study serves to prove, is that Netflix is very good at using its data, however iffy, you know, it might be, as a way to gain attention for itself.
Well, and it worked. And they said that what it proved to them was that they're really smart for doing what they always do, which is release the whole bunch of season at once.
Right.
They say this proves that we're smart. Though, why would it even prove that? Maybe if the show was only available one episode a week, people would be more likely to stay with it because they'd have a week to think about it and talk about it with their friends and get excited about the night. You know, why would that prove it? Maybe if Lost had been available the entire first season at once, you would have had a big drop off quicker. You know? Maybe the fact that you had a week to mull it over and hear weird theories and all that stuff and realize other people were watching. But if you watched it on your own in 3 days and watched 4 episodes, you might go, what the heck is this? And you might have walked away. So it doesn't prove anything. It's a stupid thing and nobody should have reported it.
Well, you know, everybody did report it because that's the way Netflix, you know,
they
managed to control the media this way. You know, if anything, if it makes one network executive look at a show and say, you know what, let's give it an extra couple weeks to see if people watch it.
But that's not what
that's not what's going to happen from this.
That's not what they did. That's not what they're arguing, and it's stupid.
No, but what they are doing is actually allowing you to subscribe on your iPhone or your iPad now. So then that's Netflix.
So they used to be they wouldn't do that because they would have to give a third of it to Apple, right?
Right. And that's actually under review right now. The Justice Department, or no, the Federal Trade Commission launched an investigation this summer into what's referred to as the App Store tax, or in certain circles, the Apple tax of that 30% for any in-app purchases, which... Mm-hmm. You know, if you are, say, Spotify and somebody subscribes to you through your iPhone or iPad app, then you are now earning $9 per month from that person, except for the fact that you have to give $3 of it to Apple, which, oh, by the way, has their own music service.
Competing service, yeah.
Yeah, it begins to get a little too antitrusty. So I have a feeling that as far as subscriptions go, I have a feeling it's going to get shot down.
Well, Netflix is still on the buying spree, of course. They're going to spend $6 billion next year on content, both their own original and licensing. And they made some licensing news. Like 2 weeks ago, they bought How to Get Away with Murder. And this week, they bought Jane the Virgin from CW, Zoo from CBS, and Colony, a sci-fi film that hasn't even started yet, on USA Network. And they all make sense, don't they? They're pushing into Latin America and Spain. So that's why they want Jane the Virgin. That should appeal, crossover to them. And the others all feel like serialized shows that play right into Netflix's strength.
Correct.
And how is it working? They got a lot of subscribers, right?
What? They have like 63 million subscribers, but that's worldwide. Not that that's bad. But no. I mean, I think some analysts are predicting that by 2020, Netflix will have 130 million subscribers. And you know what? Actually, half of Amazon Prime members are also Netflix subscribers.
So one does not cancel out the other.
Correct.
They obviously have very different libraries. So if you have Netflix and Amazon Prime, you feel like, wow, I got almost everything covered. All I need is Hulu and I'm done. But it sure adds up quick, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Netflix is $8 a month. HBO Now is $15 a month. How much is Hulu Prime or whatever Hulu
Plus? I think it's like $9 or $12
$9. A month. Yeah, suddenly you've got and, you know, and they've got some substantial libraries, of course. Amazon Prime has a library. That's like $6 a month if you work it out, though you get more than just Amazon Prime. But suddenly you're at $30, $40 and you've got like four channels.
Pretty much, yeah.
You know, it ain't easy trying to cut the cord and save money.
No, although, you know, I've been kind of monitoring my TV use and I realized, you know what, I'm just watching Netflix stuff and maybe CNN and maybe baseball.
You're not a sports guy? Yeah, because sports is the thing that pulls people back.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, with this MLB.com or MLB TV or...
But you can't get your local team on that.
I
cannot subscribe to the Yankees. You know, with you got to have your cable subscription.
And then you'll never be able to tell me what the score of the game is.
That's right.
And you know what? I wonder, you know what? I'm not going to subscribe to all these things until they have virtual reality content.
Okay. Yeah. That's the 3D didn't work in the home. And I'm like, well, people will love virtual reality. We'll make all our TV shows VR friendly. How's that going to work, Sperling?
Not well. I think, first of all, you have to put on these like goggles that like block out, what's the word I'm looking for? Everything. Actually, you can't walk around with these things on. It is fascinating. It looks fantastic in some of these demonstrations. But you then find out what they're going to do with these apps. And it's like, oh, it'll allow people to pick the content they're going to watch on their television. Then just give me a remote control. I don't need the virtual reality app. And the whole like CNN is going to live stream in virtual reality the Democratic debate on October 3rd.
Well, who cares?
You know what? Like five people have that equipment. Who cares?
Right. Well, I mean, so you have to start somewhere and you have to make content available before people do it. But for the same reason 3D didn't work in the home, I think it's the same problem with VR. You will walk to the kitchen, you get a drink, you answer your phone, you're talking to the people next to you. You can't do that when you're encased in a goggles like that. And it's just not communal friendly. And TV often is communal.
Well, and I know we often end our shows with obituaries. And I was very, very sad to hear this week that Yogi Bear had died. I didn't know that actually he was still alive. So I was first shocked that he was still alive. And I, you know, probably should have.
Hey, Bubba Bear. Finally, an obituary we get to make fun of.
Yes, because Yogi Bear, of course, is an animated character by Hanna-Barbera. I almost mispronounced
Hanna-Barbera.
Yes. And the Associated Press announced that Yogi Bear had died at the age of 90.
They, of course, messed up Yogi Bear with Yogi Berra, the acclaimed Yankee. So they said, famed Yankee Yogi Bear died at 90. So it's kind of a bizarre little thing, you know. Oh, well.
And for those outside the country, Yogi Berra was a catcher for the New York Yankees baseball team. And he,
to say the least, he was one of the greatest catchers, if not the greatest of all time. He's in the Hall of Fame. He's well known for his malapropisms. It ain't over till it's over. And, you know,
I don't go there anymore. It's too popular. Nobody goes there anymore. It's too popular.
Yeah, exactly. So he's a great character in baseball, and he is dead.
Yes, and he did pass away. But the funny thing is, Yogi Bear, supposedly the name for that Hanna-Barbera, supposedly, though he denies it, they denied it. It was taken from Yogi Berra. So,
well, yeah, they're close. Hence the mistake.
Yes, and
thank God Yogi Bear is still alive, ready to steal picnic baskets forever.
Yes, and I would say that Universal or Paramount or one, I don't know which one of them released that movie, but I'm sure some studio is happy somewhere. And we hope you're happy, actually, with this week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox. Of course, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us, subscribe to us, rate and review us. We do appreciate it when you do. You can also write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find all those links from all the stories we talked about today, including the Yogi Bear story, which was really about Yogi Berra. ShowbizSandbox.com is our website. It's where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is our username, or like us on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page will pop up and you can like us there. Again, ShowbizSandbox.com is our website. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. And Michael Giltz, every week, has a brand new website. What is it this week, Michael?
It's bookfilter.com. I'm all about Bookfilter.
Okay, so actually, in all honesty, you can go to bookfilter.com and you can find out all of Michael's picks for not only this week, but weeks and weeks and months to come for all the books that are being published. It's actually apropos for this week, don't you think, Michael?
Since absolutely. Either that or Lost in New York, but I think that's already taken.
Ah, okay. Well, I don't necessarily know what the Lost in New York is.
Lost in Thailand, Lost in Hong Kong, the Lost In franchise, the number one movie in the world.
Ah, now I get it. You see, that was so 1 hour ago that I've...
It really was.
Literally. So you can find some of Michael's work there or on michaelgiltz.com or some of his coverage of the entertainment industry on the Huffington Post. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.